It's interesting how language changes over time. Because of this, a word that has a certain denotation or connotation in one generation may have a more general or totally different meaning to another generation. Esther has told me how when she's reading books for her class, and she's reading some of the older books, how she'll have to sometimes explain a word because the students would be like, "What?" Because that word has a totally different meaning today. And so she'll have to go back and explain what it meant back when it was written. Now we find the same thing in the Bible in our English translation. For example, the King James Bible, which was published first in 1611, tells us in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse number 5, that God is a terrible God. That God is terrible. And we would stop and wonder, well, how is God terrible? And yet, that word in the original has the idea to invoke terror, to invoke awe, to invoke respect. Today, we would say our God is an awesome God. And indeed, that's how it's translated in the New King James Bible. And our God does inspire awe. And I believe that his awesomeness is especially shining forth in the biblical account of creation. Now, we need to stop for a moment and get the backdrop a little bit, too. Remember that Genesis was written by Moses. And most likely during this time of that 40 years in the wilderness. And so now they have come out of Egypt. God has delivered them from Egypt. They're in the wilderness, and they will eventually cross over the Jordan River into the land of promise. Now, the land of promise is occupied by pagan people. They have various gods and various goddesses, and they have an entire mythology that is based upon that. And so Moses was explaining here in Genesis to the Israelites about to enter that promised land, that the true God of creation was vastly different from the false gods of the surrounding nations. The gods we would look back today and say the gods of mythology. The true God was a God that inspired awe and reverence because he's all-powerful. He's all-knowing. He's all-present. And we find this especially in the drama of creation. Now, we already saw last week how God set the stage for this creation drama during the first 3 days, and how he formed what needed to be formed and separated what needed to be separated. Now we turn our attention to his awesome workings during the next 3 days. And we find here that the actors arrive on God's great creation drama. In other words, he has now formed the earth, and now he's going to fill the earth and the universe in these next 3 days. Now, this morning we're going to focus just upon, I believe, day 4. And in day number 4, we find the light bearers fill the night skies in verses 14 through 19. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let it be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens, to give light on the earth." And it was so. You'll remember back in day 1 that God had separated the firmament aspect, and so basically there was now the idea of a sky, and there was the world. And so there was this aspect of water below and water above. Now God is going to fill the outer skies with what he wants there. And we find here the purposes of the sun, the moon, the stars. For purpose number 1 obviously comes to mind is for light. But let's stop and think about that for a second. For 3 days, there had already been light. Verse number 4, God had said, "Let there be light." Now, here on day number 4, he's going to actually have light holders. There was already light during the day, as if there were a sun in the sky. There was already light somewhat at night, as if there had been a moon present. And there were, as if there had been stars out there. And to be honest, God could have left it that way. He didn't have to form a sun. He didn't have to form a moon. He could have just left the light coming kind of supernaturally the way it had been already. But he did not. He created the lights, the sun, the moon, the stars, not just for light, oh, but for other things. And we notice here for signs. Now, for signs, we know that it's going to be signs for the seasons and things of that, but also the idea that it teaches. It reminds men and women that there is a creator and of his creative work. The psalmist says in Psalm 19, verse 1, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork." And again, we see in the Hebrew poetry, there's a parallelism. He states it one way, the heavens do this, and then he states it again, the firmament. Remember, the firmament includes the sky, what we see up above us. So when we look up in the day and we see the sun blazing, it reminds us God put it there. When we look out at night and we see the countless stars and we see the moon, we remember God put those there. And then for seasons. Well, seasons, they function as a calendar. They divide seasons. I mean, they also help divide days and years, enabling us to plan our work and to make plans. Could you imagine if there were no sun, if there was no day and night as we think about it with the moon, and we were just going on? Time would not seem to function the way we normally function. I mean, I know that next month on such and such a date, I need to go and pick up Beth at Liberty University. If it wasn't for us having months, it'd be rather difficult for us to plan things like that. It'd be hard to plan vacations and plan work schedules and plan other things. It's the Earth's movement in relation to the sun and the moon that determine our seasons of the calendar, our days and nights, which he goes on here to say, and for days and years. And so because of the sun and the moon, we have our days, we have our years, we have our months. But this has a specific significance for the Jewish people. They had been given now at Mount Sinai their religious observations, that every month they were to have an observation at the beginning of a new moon, that every week they were to have a Sabbath day beginning on Friday night and going through Saturday at sundown, that they had every so often in the year they would have special feast days. And if they had not had that, something to be able to figure it out by, how were they going to know when the Sabbath began, when the Sabbath ended, when it was the new month, and when it was time to celebrate the annual feasts? And so they're being told by Moses, God telling through Moses, God gave us these for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. And then Moses goes on here under the inspiration of God to say, then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. Let's think about these, the designations. There is these two great lights. There is, first of all, the sun. Now, when we think about the Hebrew here for lights, it means light givers, light bearers. We might say luminaries. He made sources for the light that he had already created. Now, the fact that the sun and moon are both called light givers or light bearers does not suggest that they're same in substance. Some people would say, well, you see, the Bible's just a book of silliness. It's almost as if they didn't know better back then, and they thought that the moon radiated light like the sun does. Oh, no, that's not what it's saying at all. Actually, we know that the sun generates light while the moon only reflects such light. But when it says that they both give light, that was as far as their function was concerned relative to the earth. The sun radiated the light during the day and it gave light. The moon at night gave light by reflection. It's not trying to say that the light actually came from the sun, came from the moon. It's reflected off the moon by the sun. There's no scientific problem here, but it does show that God gave us wonderfully a moon at night. so that we could actually see and do different things usually and stuff with that reflected off of there. And it's wonderful. Now, do you notice something interesting in this passage? Moses doesn't say God gave us the sun and God gave us the moon using those terms. He just says God gave a light and a greater light and a lesser light, one for night, one for day. He doesn't call them sun and moon. Why? Because the nations around the Israelites worshiped the sun and the moon. And God here isn't going even to deign give them their names. He just says, I created the lights. I'm not even going to bother to name them. The ancient people were fascinated with the moon and with the stars and the movement of the sun and planets. And it was only a short step from admiring what God had given to beginning to worship what God had created. And God is telling us here that it was He, God, not some other deity that created the lights. We realize that Israel had originated with Abraham from Mesopotamia, where the celestial bodies were worshipped. And more recently, they had come out of Egypt, where the sun was worshipped as a primary deity. And so God is putting them in their place and saying, they're not gods. They're merely my creation. And let's think about what God did create. The sun. Did you know that the sun makes up 99% of the total mass of our solar system? 99%. It's that large. The sun is a sphere of hot gas 860,000 miles in diameter. That's 109 times the diameter of the Earth. The sun's mass is 1,000,000 times that of the Earth. The surface temperature of the sun is nearly 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And they estimate that at the core of the sun, the temperature is nearly 28 million degrees Fahrenheit. Each square inch of the sun's surface has the intensity of 300,000 candles. And we don't even take in all the power of the sun. Only 1 billionth, with a B, billionth of the sun's energy output actually strikes Earth. The rest just streams out in all directions in the space. In just 1 second, the sun releases more energy than mankind has produced since its creation, including all the engine, power plants, weapons ever constructed. And yet they say the fuel gauge on the Earth's, on the sun's power, if you would, barely has moved. It's still full. Its energy reserves are nearly inexhaustible. What an awesome God we have to create the sun. And then in love, He not only gave us the sun, and in His wisdom, He gave us second also the moon. Now, we don't worship the moon, but God gave us the moon for very good purposes. The moon is approximately 1/4 the size of the Earth. And it's 7,928 miles in diameter. It is the perfect size and distance from us to cause a total solar eclipse. Now that would seem impossible because the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. If you just look at the moon and look at the sun, you think they're the same size, but the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. Well, why do they look the same time size? Because the moon is 400 times closer to us than the sun. And so they look identical. As a result, we can have solar and lunar eclipses. And the scientists who are involved in astronomy, they say because of the way the moon goes perfectly over the sun and you can have that little bit extra coming, they can learn so much about the sun because of these eclipses. Computer studies show that this phenomenon is unique to our moon. It is not known for any other moon in our solar system. If you were on any of the other planets and looked out, you would never have a solar eclipse like we have solar eclipses. It would not happen. God gave us our moon perfect distance so we could have it that way. And our moon, otherwise, also serves several important purposes. First of all, it gives us our month, a lunar month of 28 days. But secondly, and we don't stop to realize this, it stabilizes the Earth's tilt on its axis, the tilt, the angle. With no moon, the Earth's axis would swing erratically due to the gravity pulls of the sun and the other planets. Seasons would be unpredictable and much more severe. Indeed, it would lead to permanent freezing of the oceans and would end all life. Thus, we owe our stable climate largely to the moon that God gave us. Thirdly, we have the ocean tides. Tides and wind together generate ocean currents worldwide. And studies have shown that the tides dominate that process. Now, tides are caused by the moons and are essential to the health of the oceans. Without these major stirrings of the seas, the waters have become stagnant, like a pond, and unhealthy. Sea life would die, including the abundant plant life in the oceans. And if sea plants perished, the Earth's atmosphere would rapidly deteriorate, resulting in an insufficient amount of oxygen for life. But we have an awesome God who put the moon right where it needed to be and caused everything to be just the way it was and is, so we have life on this planet. And then it says, he made the stars also. Now, that statement, he made the stars also, is a remarkable statement, especially to the ancient world. In the ancient Middle East, other religions worshipped, deified, and mystified the stars. Israel's neighbors revered the stars and looked to them for guidance. Think of the horoscopes. Even you have today, people, horoscopes, the stars determine our destiny. Baloney. That's not what God gave them for. But the writing of horoscopes and this stuff began in Babylon. The idea of going to the stars and thinking that they determined life. And so they looked to them for guidance. In contrast, the biblical story gives the stars only the barest mention in this account. It's as if the writer just shrugged his shoulders and said, oh no, yes, by the way, he also made the stars. They're not significant compared to God's overall plan, but he made them as well. Such a statement showed great contempt for the ancient Babylonian astrology. Now, when we think of the stars, think of the awesomeness of our God. The universe is vast. Matter of fact, it's basically mind-boggling. Now, a light beam crossing just our solar system, our planets in the solar system, would require more than 10 hours for the trip. But to speak of light crossing the universe, scientists had to come up with a new designation. They refer to light years. Light years is a distance that light would travel in 1 year. Now, since light travels at 186,282 miles per second, we would multiply this by the number of seconds in a year and discover that a light year is about 6 trillion miles. Wow. Our nearest star is 4.3 light years away. Some stars are hundreds or even thousands of light years away. God created all of that. Contrast that to the sun, which is only 8 light minutes away. Now, we look up at the skies. On a clear moonless night, if you don't have the glow of cities or towns around you and you don't have your own lights outside, on a clear night with no other light, about 3,000 stars are visible to the unaided eye. A small telescope will increase that number to about 100,000 stars. But that's just the beginning. The stars that we can see in the night sky are only in our corner of the Milky Way galaxy. The entire galaxy numbers about 100 billion stars with a B. And beyond the Milky Way galaxy are other galaxies of different shapes and sizes. Indeed, around, they say, 100 billion galaxies are known to exist. Now, if we take the Milky Way galaxy as an average galaxy, that means we'd have to take 100 billion times 100 billion to have an idea how many stars are in the sky. The total number would then be known, they calculated, as 10 billion trillion stars. And God created all of them. And yet, no two stars, they say, have exactly the same properties. Just like God in his creation creates snowflakes, and no two snowflakes are the same. He's created all those stars, and no two stars are the same. And we read in Psalm 147, verse 4, and Isaiah 40, verse 26, that God still knows them all by name. He names each one of them, and he has count of each of them. We just talked about how powerful and large our sun is. But as large as our sun is, there are far greater stars in the universe. Arcturus is a yellow-red star, the fourth brightest in the sky. It is 20 times larger than our sun. 20 times. Aldebaran is in the eye of the constellation Taurus the Bull. It is a red giant about 70 light years away and is 45 solar diameters in size. In other words, 45 larger in diameter than our sun. Antares is a orange-red star, the eye of the Scorpion constellation. It has a diameter 700 times the size of our sun and shines at the brightness of 9,000 suns. It is said to be so large it would swallow 64 million suns, the size of ours, inside. Betelgeuse, in the right shoulder of Orion the Hunter, has a diameter 1,200 times that of the sun. It also gives off 120,000 times as much light as our sun. And then there's Epsilon. Epsilon is so vast in diameter, it's 3,000 times that of our sun and has a volume some 27 billion times our sun. In other words, you could fit 24 billion of our suns inside of it. Do we have an awesome God? God created all of this. And by the way, it's not named here, separately, but God also created the planets. The planets. You see, to the ancients, the planets, they considered stars. Anything out in the sky basically was a star, with the Greek word stares. But they knew there was a difference. They knew that the stars had a fixed location. And yes, they would move across the night sky, but they would move across the night sky in that same way all the time. They'd be changing during the season, but they could keep track of these stars. But there were some stars that just didn't play the game right. Those stars seemed to move different locations. They called them wandering stars. Today we call them planets. And we know they didn't play by the rules of stars because they weren't stars in that aspect. They had their own rotations, and that's why they changed location in the night sky. Now, as we look at all of our planets, and the kids got me a shirt a couple years ago. It said, in my day, we had more planets. We also had Pluto. Poor Pluto got knocked down. I still like to think of Pluto as a planet, but whatever.
But we think it.
Yeah, we had a memory. We memorized all the way out to Pluto. Now they've taken Pluto and said, no, it's not a planet. But if you look at all of them, none of them could support life. Now, for years, people wondered, could there be life on the other planets? And our sci-fi writers write stories about life on other planets. But within my lifetime, we have sent out so many spacecraft, unmanned spacecraft, to monitor these planets and take pictures and learn. We've landed a remote control aspect on Mars and everything else. We know that there's no way that life could be on the other planets the way we think of human life. Let's just look at our nearest neighbors, just two of them, Venus and Mars. For years, people said, well, Venus is our next door neighbor, and so maybe it has life. I mean, we can see it looks like it has a cloud cover. Maybe it has life like we have life here. But due to its severely tilted axis, the daytime there lasts nearly 4 months. How'd you like 4 months of daylight? The temperature there, because of its cloud covering and everything else and closeness to the sun, is a whopping 850 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't think that's where I want to take my vacation. Atmospheric pressure is over 1,300 pounds per square inch. And though Venus is almost the same size as Earth and our closest neighbor, just 28% nearer the sun, it clearly is not designated for habitation. Life couldn't live there. Then look at Mars. People thought, well, Mars. People used to talk about Martians. We had the War of the Worlds with H.G. Wells, and then the radio broadcast with Orson Welles, no relation, and all the different things, and people were terrorized. Maybe we're going to be invaded from Mars. Well, let's think about Mars. Mars is only 52% farther from the sun than Earth, but temperatures there dive to nearly 200 degrees below zero. The hottest day of the year on Mars is still minus 24 degrees Fahrenheit. The year is nearly 687 days long. Nothing resembling life could thrive on Mars. It's the same with the other planets. But then let's stop and think about how awesome our God is. I mean, those are beautiful to observe. They're beautiful to see pictures of. If you can see them through a telescope, it's magnificent to see like the rings of Saturn or something like that. They're just beautiful what God has done. But no life. Why? Because the Earth is in the right place, the right tilt of the axis, not too close, not too far away. Perfect size moon at the perfect distance. Everything else to provide life on this planet. They call it the Goldilocks effect. It's just right. If any of these were thrown off, we wouldn't be living here. When I was a teenager, Carl Sagan was on TV and he talked about the billions and billions of planets out there, all of which should be able to have life. Well, we know now, no. They have to be in the perfect place, the perfect distance, the perfect type sun. If our planet were closer to some of these larger ones, we wouldn't even exist. It'd be burned up. It has to be perfect. And some of these are dual stars. The switch, there can't be life with anything of that nature. And so the challenge for astronomers now is to try to find another Goldilocks planet. And it's so difficult, if not impossible, to do. But our God has done it for us. Our God is an awesome God who reigns in heaven above. He is worth our worship, our love, our honor. He is worthy for us to come to know Him as Savior, as well as Creator, and to live for Him. Our Father in heaven, we thank You for this, that we learn. Just, dear Lord, on day four of creation, of how awesome You are. And we look forward to looking at days five and six and see also more of the awesomeness of Your creation on this planet. And help us, dear Lord, to look to you in awe and respect and in love. In Jesus' name, amen. And you are dismissed. May God be with you and bless you as you go your ways.